Okay, good Erev Shabbos, everybody. We are in the middle of the series that we call the Chasson Shir You Wish You Had But Never Got. And this is, I believe, session number 7. We'll talk in a minute about the content of today's shir. But again, I remind everybody, listeners that are listening and now, and those that may be listening later, that this is very sensitive subject material. They should be listened sequentially, meaning you should start with the first shir and not skip, because there's a progression of ideas and a development of ideas that are much more accurately understood through the process. If people have any questions, would like to send in a question, they could text to 718-793-1376, 718-793-1376, or email me to look at a later time a more involved question, to email me at simchafeuermann@gmail.com, which is simchafeuermann@gmail.com. You can find me also, my email somewhere on the Gardurai site. I also remind people that I'm no posik. What we talk about here are Torah ideas, and I will give you the sources and psychological ideas, and I will let you know my thoughts and opinions about those things. However, I'm no posik, and if there are things that come up that are halachic, people need to seek guidance in that way. And lastly, again, I remind people that this is a very, very sensitive subject matter. It's really not the way it's done to speak about these things in a public forum. However, it does seem that it's something necessary, that it's harashah, that people should have a degree of knowledge and guidance in an area that shame has stopped people from getting hadracha that they really need. Now, the subject matter that we've been talking about for the last week or two has been based on a few emails that people have sent that they're in a marriage where the experience is such that their wife is not interested in sex at all, or very little, or in some ways seems to be distant in that direction. And we have begun to talk about different approaches to improve that situation. Of course, someone pointed out last week that it's not limited only to men. There could be women in marriages where the man is not interested in sex, although perhaps it's statistically less. It's definitely a concern. So these ideas, to some extent, are generalizable, although I'm speaking to a greater extent about classical male and female roles and responses. Okay, so we discussed in the last two shiurim a couple of different approaches, and I want to continue with exploring different approaches and to talk about what we would call strategy number 4. Now, what's important to understand about relationships is that oftentimes relationships that are excessively controlling result in a passive-aggressive response from the other party. And this is only natural. Basically, it's within the human psyche to feel competent and to feel powerful. There's a very strong drive to feel competence and feel power. And therefore, individuals that find themselves in situations where they are either emotionally or physically overpowered, the way that people intuitively retain power is by engaging in passive forms of aggression, passive forms of rebellion, or avoidance. And these reactions could be even utterly unconscious, where the person who's doing it is not even aware they're doing it. But classic passive-aggressive behavior, one sees in children, because children oftentimes perceive themselves to be powerless, right? So if it's time to go to school, time to go to yeshiva, and the child doesn't want to go, and you wake him up, and you try to get him to go, he gets dressed very slowly, he can't find his yarmulke, he lost his knapsack, right? Or parents sometimes try, mostly futilely, to force their kids to daven in shul. And you know, you force a kid to sit down and daven, and he'll do everything but daven. He'll fidget, he'll pick his nose, he'll wrinkle and dog ear the page, he'll drop the sitter, right? So passive-aggressive behavior is oftentimes the only reasonable response to a situation where the other person feels controlled. And as I said, it can be unconscious, and the drive itself is a rather constructive drive. It's just mischanneled. The drive is that everybody needs to feel competent. And if you can't feel competent and in control in the direct way, because you cannot take on the authority, because the authority is either physically overpowering or emotionally overpowering, then the end result is some kind of passive form of avoidance, rebellion, feet dragging, and the like. Now, in a relationship, one of the great killers of desire and spontaneous romance is if one partner feels overpowered and controlled, because love and passion and the feelings of love and passion and arousal come in an environment where the person feels a certain sense of integrity, a certain sense of self-mastery. And in a relationship where one partner is very paternalistic or very controlling, what you end up is not with a lover, you end up with a child. And as you know, healthy people have no interest in having sex with their children or their fathers. So if the relationship gets transformed into a sense where one spouse is taking on a parental role, because either the spouse has a dysfunctional need for power and control, or it is possible that the other spouse, due their own immaturities, induced these reactions. In other words, if you act like a child and you're mature, you'll induce other adults to treat you like a child and change the relationship. But when that happens, right, when that occurs, just because it's a reaction doesn't mean that it is healthy or functional. And then also people get into habits. So perhaps even as one spouse might have matured and developed more independence, the other spouse is used to relating to the person in a much more paternalistic, condescending way. And when there's control and when there's power, oftentimes the other party engages in retreat, emotional and otherwise. And that's the passive-aggressive response to too much control and too much power. Now, there are, of course, relationships that, for different reasons, work when there's this kind of power play, because each person, for lack of a better way of saying it, each of the person gets off on that. And if a relationship works that way, where one person is very controlling and the other person is very submissive, one person is dominant, the other one likes being pushed around or whatever, I'm not here to argue with something that works if both people are happy with it. But even those relationships may be stable for some period of time and then later change. So, for instance, you could have a young couple where the wife really admires her husband and is very happy in a subservient role. And the husband could be indeed very controlling, partially due to his own personality flaws, and partially perhaps his wife in some way induces it because of her dependence or her immaturity. And that might work very well. Each might be very happy. He might be filled with the power and the enjoyment of being the king of the house, and she might be filled with the joy of knowing that she's being taken care of by this giant father figure. However, people oftentimes don't stay the same, and they grow and they get older. So that same woman in her 30s or 40s or 50s might have a different feeling about herself and a self-concept. And as she develops a greater sense of independence and about what she wants and how she wants to be treated, she may start to resent the controlling behavior. Now, the other spouse feels perfectly fine with it and doesn't even understand what's going on. Or, like I said, may have his own personality flaws, that being controlling was a part of how he did business. So these are where it begins to become problematic. And a lot of times in the sexual arena, it plays itself out, because a person that feels controlled will retreat emotionally, and also in some way will hold on to the power unconsciously, but reassert power, because the ability to say no is one of the most fundamental abilities that everybody has. Even young children, oftentimes, their first word is no, because it's much easier to know what you don't want than to know what you want. And I'm not an anthropologist or a linguist, but I'm fairly certain that in almost every culture, the universal word for no is moving your head from side to side vigorously. And if you just use a little imagination, you'll understand that the young infant, I'm talking pre-verbal, 3 months old, 4 months old, when he or she is nursing and doesn't wish to nurse anymore, will vigorously shake his or her head from side to side to stop nursing and to push away the mother's breast. And that's why the universal word for no is moving your head from side to side, because it's one of the first ways in which we assert ourselves as individuals, by saying no, and by moving our head from side to side. So, where does that all put us? That puts us in a situation where, inside a marriage, a person might be getting a no. So, what do you do about that? Well, you need to really take stock, because it's like quicksand, right? The more you try to fight it, the deeper you get. So the more angry and the more frustrated you get, and the more you try to control in order to really have what in some sense you deserve, you're not going to get, because you become even more controlling. And that sets up a terrible cycle. And fear and anxiety are not very good at creating conditions where a person is going to feel arousal. So what one really has to look at very carefully is the cycle of control, and to introduce into the relationship a lot of respect and mutuality and safety. And it's not going to be a quick fix, because patterns have been set that are unconscious and deeply rooted. So this is not going to be you're not going to see instant results. However, that is something to study very, very careful, very, very carefully, because it can yield a lot of fruit, and that ein adam roa nige atzmo. So it can be sometimes very hard to even notice how a person is being controlling, and how to change that. And it's oftentimes a subject of a good couple of counseling sessions, but that is the concept. And there's a very interesting Rashi in Gemara Gittin on Daf Tzadi Amud Aleph that talks about the dangers of too much control. He relates a story of a fellow named Pappus ben Yehuda, who was married to Miriam Megadla Neshaya, which was a derogatory term. Somebody who braided was somebody who was a Natsnias, and I'm not a big expert here in history and such, but I think that she was the same character in the Christian writings, Miriam of Magdalene. But anyway, but Rashi talks about this woman who's married to Pappas ben Yehuda, and here's what Rashi says in Gittin on Tzadi Amud Aleph. He says, "Kishiyotz me beisu lashuk, Noel delas befaneha." When he would go to the market, he would lock her inside the house. Shelo tadabra l'chol adam, because he was afraid she shouldn't speak to anybody. In other words, he was very controlling and very jealous. Umida sheina hogenasi. This is not a proper mida. Why? Rashi says, Shemi toch kach, because of that over-controlling and over-jealous behavior, Eva nichneses beinehem, there will be hatred, and I would suppose a more psychologically nuanced translation would be, there would be resentment, right? Eva nichneses beinehem, there would be a resentment. Umizana tachtov, and she'll end up committing adultery in a spiteful, passive-aggressive way. By the way, not for today's shmooze, but something for everybody to think about is that oftentimes sexual acting out in a relationship is passive-aggressive in its very nature. Oftentimes it is an unconscious effort at undermining and hurting the other partner, and it's really not for today's discussion, but something to file away and study in your own journey and look at yourself. So the bottom line is, for this strategy is to recognize and really assess your relationship and to what degree control and therefore the resultant passive-aggressive retreat and avoidance is playing a factor in your relationship, and to whatever extent that you could identify it, to correct it. Perhaps it can be done by a person by themselves if they're very insightful and honest with themselves, or perhaps one needs hadracha. But that is that's strategy number four. Now, strategy number five is its own piece, and I don't know if we're going to have time to cover it all today. But strategy number five is to understand that, as we mentioned in previous shiurim, that women have plenty of interest in being sexual, theoretically, and they have plenty of capacity to enjoy all the intense feelings that men do, and maybe more. But the nature is not necessarily to be quickly aroused, and so there is a real danger that if in the course of a normal, intimate relationship, if the woman is constantly going to be disappointed and only be partially aroused or not receive sufficient physical attention, and knowing how to do that is in and of itself a very complex parsha, because people need to listen and hear and understand what actually is pleasing to the other person. But in any case, if there's that constant feeling of disappointment and frustration, it won't take long before avoidance of the whole piece begins to play. And if a person is frustrated and turned off, it's very hard to bring them around again, because there's this, there's just this feeling that it's hopeless. And there's oftentimes, when it comes to these matters, there's a great deal of shame and guilt and a feeling that one doesn't deserve. So if a woman feels frustrated and is not getting what she wants, instead of saying, "I'm not getting what I want," she may just feel ashamed and that I don't deserve it. And then again, unconsciously, there's going to be a lot of avoidance. Now, the Gemara is a very important Gemara about this, about a man's obligation toward his wife. And the Gemara in Nida on Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph, and Amud Beis quotes a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim. The pasuk says, "Vayiyu v'nei Ulam," and they were the sons of Ulam, "Anoshim gibori chayil," men of valor, "Dorchei keshes," they were able to press the bow. Umar bin Banu bin Bnei Banim, and they would have sons and grandsons. Now the Pashim Shan, the Pasuk is talking about these warriors. However, you know that Chazal oftentimes look at things, especially having to do with warfare and other valorous traits. They look at them in terms of ruchnius, because the greatest war is the war over, you know, oneself. And Ezehu Gibor Hakovish Etz Yisrael, right? Who is the strong man, the one who conquers his Yetzer? Or in Mishlei it says, Tov something milochid ir, I forget the first part, but you know, someone Tov Moshe Barucho, I think, someone who manages his own spirit, his own emotions, is stronger than one who captures a city. So when it talks about these Bnei Ulam, who were very powerful warriors, they're talking about a different power. And what does the Gemara need to say? The pasuk in some way sounds like that their warrior qualities, their strength is they're able to have many sons and grandsons. Literally, they're learning banim as sons, not banim as children. Again, this is a drash, because in Hebrew you can say plural banim could mean children, men and women together, male and female children. But the drash is banim ubnei banim, sons and grandsons. So how could it be possible for a person to, through their strength, to have sons and grandsons specifically over daughters? One other thing to know is in Chazal's language, a bow oftentimes refers to the act of being mazria zera, of giving forward the zera, because it's yorek echetz, it shoots out like an arrow. Vateshev be'esan kashto, that's when Yaakov was talking about Yosef, and that Yosef withheld his strength, meaning he did not end up committing an avera with Eshes Potiphar. He was strong with his bow. The bow refers to something in the male strength, in him being Masriya Zera. And so here these warriors that press their bows, what are we talking about, and what strength did they have, and how did that strength allow them to have sons and grandsons? So here's where the Gemara says a lesson. It says, El mitoch shemashin atzman babetan, because they delayed on the belly, literally, it means they delayed on the belly, which means that they were able to stay in the act of intercourse, and they did not ejaculate, they were not mazriya, they were able to delay in the act of intercourse, kedei shiazriyo nishasein tchila. So the women, and I'll translate this literally, and then let's use common sense, so that the women would give forth their seed first, shiyubanim zacharim. So then they'll have male children. So what are we talking about over here? So, you know, biologically speaking, if women were mazriya, it means that they give, that they ovulate, that the egg somehow or another gets released and is in the fallopian tubes. Well, I don't know whether Chazal were aware of that or not. It's a rather sophisticated physiological process, and that it might not have, they might not have been aware of that. Even if they were, they weren't interested in, if they knew scientific things that were beyond the time of their science, they wouldn't use it in a metaphor to explain anything. The Maariv Chayes, in his introduction to Agarata, which you can find in many printed editions of the Ein Yaakov, talks about how Chazal would use the science of the times for metaphors, even if they didn't agree with it. They would use the science of the times. So a regular person would not think of ovulation when he thinks of a woman being mazriya, a woman giving off seed. What would you think is a woman being mazriya? Well, when a man is mazriya, we know what that looks like, right? So when a woman has the same experience, basically when a woman orgasms, that's her being mazriya. That's what Chazal meant. So, because they were using what people could understand, regardless of the science behind it, when a woman orgasms, she does not give off any seed, as far as we know today scientifically. That's irrelevant. What is relevant is that they're saying over here that if the man is able to delay himself being mazriya and allows his wife to be mazriya first, then the reward for that, for not gratifying their own desires first and being able to control themselves, which is a great gevura, the reward for that is that they will have male children, which was considered a very big privilege and a very big benefit. Now, without getting into all kinds of modern social and other ideas about men and women, these chazals could be understood completely economically. The fact of the matter is that if a man had sons, he was a wealthy person. If a man had daughters, he was in debt. Because imagine you had a farm, which most people did in those days, if you had a farm, and you had seven sons, you had a retirement plan. Your seven sons will work the field and produce the crops, feed you, and feed themselves. If you had seven daughters, you would need to find a dowry to marry them off, and they certainly were not going to work the fields or plow the fields. So we're not talking about anything sophisticated, about who's better, who are on a higher madriga. It's another discussion, but this is simply economics, that it was a tremendous benefit for a man to have sons and grandsons because that was their 401k plan. That was their retirement plan. And when you didn't have a social safety net and you didn't have Social Security, you better darn well have a good 401k. And that was it. So anyway, the reward, getting back to the point here, is the reward for giving the woman pleasure and making sure that she is mazriya first is this benefit of having the sons. Now, how do we know that this is a reward and this is giving her pleasure, aside from common sense? So the Gemara goes on to counsel that if one is not able to withhold and hold back themselves from being mazriya, another etza is to be bol v'shona, to have intercourse a second time. Now, there's another Gemara in Erevin on Daf Kuf Amud Beis, which warns, of course, the second time it has to be with the woman's consent and has to be with the intent, with holy intent, and not just to be completely indulgent. But the point is that assuming you meet that criteria and you're bo'al v'shona, so now there's additional contact and additional affection that the wife is getting. And so then you still could create a situation where she gets the pleasure. And make no mistake, this is about her getting the pleasure. Rashi in Erevin says shemechamas bia rishona nisava isha v'hulbasha taiva, because of the first bia, the woman started to feel a taiva, but she wasn't fully satisfied. I'm adding that parenthetically, but that's what Rashi means to say. And if this person, he was mazriya first, if he's able to be mezgaber and have intercourse a second time, kishaba bia shniya, when you have the second intercourse, he mezras tchila, then she is mazras, then she has her pleasure. V'heichat he mazras tchila yulad zachar, and the reward for that is that she will conceive of a male child. So there's a lot to speak about in this area, and we're going to have to stop the shiur. This will be continued next week. I do just want to say one very important point, which is that people. It's a very common problem, which in secular language is called premature ejaculation. But plainly put, it's a very common problem that some men are not able to control when they're being mazriya, and they're not able to engage in intercourse for a long enough amount of time that's really satisfying for the woman, which creates this frustration and this shame. And oftentimes it's a secret shame, because a woman doesn't even want to make her husband feel bad, but the end is there's this retreat and a lack of interest in being together in the bedroom that comes from this. And that problem is absolutely 100% utterly solvable. It's not for today's shiur, and it's probably not something that I can give in detail over in a shiur, but it's very important to understand that it is a behavioral, emotional response that can be completely and totally modified and mastered. Any man, any single man, can have complete and total control over when they're masriya, and there are ways to achieve that, which is a discussion for another time. What I'm going to do is just stop the mute to give a chance for a question if anybody has, and then we will stop the shiur. Again, people can text 718-793-1376 or email questions, which will help me figure out if what we're talking about is in line of what you want to hear. The email is Simcha, S-I-M-C-H-A, Feuerman, F-E-U-E-R-M-A-N, @gmail.com. Hold on, I'm going to unmute. Okay, no mitzvah to ask questions if you don't want to, because I'm running late for time, but if someone does have a quick question, I'm certainly open to hearing it.
Rabbi Feuerman, thank you for the shiurim so far. One way to review your talks is to go over each recorded talk and take some notes. But you mentioned that there are now five techniques. I don't recall five. Are you able to write anything up in very brief form, you know, technique one, technique two, and whatever, and post it on an email anywhere? Or would you rather not do that?
I don't want to do that, but I'll tell you what I will do. I'm going to make a note to review all the techniques, okay, next week. We'll do a summary, okay?
Thank you.
That's a fair request. And it could be that I didn't label them as such. You know, it's not, ironically, it's not Torah Misinai, even though it might be Torah, or accidentally Misinai, but I'm not doing it as Torah Misinai, these techniques. But on the other side, I might have called it five instead of six or two instead of three, but the ideas are there. But I will try, Lina, next week to review where we're up to. It's Kedai anyway. And then we'll continue. So I do have to run, but people feel free to email and such, and we should all have a good week.
Thank you so much for the shiurim.
Take care.
Take care.